This is the Cascade Hiker Podcast. You're going to find out all the aspects of hiking in our beautiful Pacific Northwest woods.
I'm a country boy with a soft side. My heart wanders up north to the hillside. And I've never met anyone quite as beautiful as you.
Check us out over at CascadeHikerPodcast.com. That's right, CascadeHikerPodcast.com. That's where you're going to find all the show notes and links right there.
Enigmatic like that of the cosmos, never held your hand.
I want to thank Whiskey Fever for letting me use that awesome track there. That was Tall Grass off their album, Gonna Wake Up This Whole Town. Find them at ReverbNation.com/Whiskey Fever. They're from Cedro Woolley. Go check them out. I'm your host, Rudy Getzik. I put this podcast together to inspire you to get out on the trail. Are you putting in 2-mile hikes, 5-mile hikes? You sitting on the couch? Have you even gone on a backpacking trip yet? I'm going to introduce you to some folks that have done that and a whole lot more. So without further ado, here is the Cascade Hiker Podcast. All right, next on the Cascade Hiker Podcast, what's your name and where are you from?
Hi there, my name is Chase Gannell. I'm the Communications Director for Conservation Northwest. We're a regional wildlife and wildlands conservation organization. We've been based out of Bellingham for about 25 years, but I work out of Seattle. And one thing I should say is that while I do a lot of work on different wildlife and wilderness issues around the Northwest, I am not a representative of the National Park Service, nor am I a park ranger or a bear safety expert or biologist. I think it's important that folks know that as we talk about some grizzly bear and other bear issues today. I am someone that spends a lot of time in bear country. I've had my share of bear experiences, and I've been working on this and other related issues for going on about a decade now, but I am not a member of the government. Just want to make that clear.
All right, that's good. Well, hey, let's just dive right into it. So we're talking, I found you talking on a thread, defending yourself, because there's just a lot of stuff going on with this grizzly bear reintegration topic. So why don't you just kind of give some hot points on kind of what that means? What is that grizzly reintroduction?
Yeah, I'll just lead us into it. So if folks don't know, we have grizzly bears in Washington State. We have two populations of them. There's a small number up in Northeast Washington, maybe around 50 or so, that flirt between Northern Idaho, Northeast Washington, and Southeast British Columbia. And really where this issue is under debate right now is in the North Cascades, the other population. Currently, experts believe there are less than 10 grizzly bears in the North Cascades. There have been some recent sightings on the British Columbia side as recently as 2015 and others in 2010 and 2012. But on the Washington side, we haven't had a confirmed grizzly bear sighting since 1996. And by all indications, that population has been in a long-term decline and is on the verge of extirpation or local extinction. So what this means is that we've got a species that's native to our region. It's an important part of the ecosystem. It's an important piece of the cultural heritage of local Native Americans and arguably to our Northwest natural heritage. And it's an animal that might not be around much longer without action. So the National Park Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and other agencies have been conducting a 3-year environmental impact statement process to understand and plan and take public input on how best to restore grizzly bears in the North Cascades. And that word restore is important. This is not a reintroduction effort. This is a species that has existed in our region for thousands of years and is still out there, if in very few numbers. And that restoration or recovery action is something that's part of the Federal Endangered Species Act. When animals are endangered, our government has an obligation to restore them in areas of quality habitat. And in 1991, the North Cascades were designated an area with that sort of high quality habitat as a federal grizzly bear recovery zone. So it took 30 years, but now we are here to the point where agencies and conservation groups like myself and other wildlife interests and members of the public are getting together and discussing, should we bring bears back to the North Cascades? Should we help restore a healthy population? And if we do so, how do we do it?
Oh, that's great information. So what is the Conservation Northwest, what is the role for that organization in this restoring?
Well, in really short, we're a cheerleader. But more than that, we are an organization that's been working on this issue for more than 25 years now. And it's something that's really core to our roots in North Cascades, based out of Bellingham. Myself and many others who work for the organization spend a lot of time in this area. We've worked with biologists on grizzly bears and other species in the North Cascades and in southern British Columbia for decades. So we see ourselves as an entity that can help advocate for this process, but also build bridges between communities to share information, because this is a complicated issue. It's an issue where there are legitimate concerns and questions. And we think that having straightforward, approachable information that helps answer some of those questions is vitally important. And we can do that in a way that maybe is more nimble than some of the government agencies that are leading this process.
Oh, that's great. Well, what I would say probably the biggest concern, you kind of mentioned it with the Eastern Washington, Idaho, and Southern Canada, is that, there's no fences, there's no borders, for these animals. So is that kind of the biggest concern for people then, the fact that these grizzlies will just be roaming? And is that the scare?
Well, that's certainly a question that I've heard, or a concern that I've heard, and I know some of my colleagues at the Park Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service have heard it as well. I'm not sure it's the biggest concern. And in many ways, that concern is, in much of this issue, this is applicable, but for that concern specifically, it's as much about other species as it is about grizzly bears. And the main species that concern tends to be filtered through is wolves. People think about wolf recovery in the Northern Rockies or in Washington, where you've got a species that's known to go on 1,000-mile walkabouts and have 6 puppies a year. And they wonder whether that's going to be the case with grizzly bears as well. And really, I think this is a great example of where the information is key here. And the information when it comes to grizzly bears is that they're a very different species than wolves or even a smaller animal like wolverines. These are not an animal that reproduces quickly. In fact, typically mother grizzly bears will have cubs only about every 3 to 5 years, and then they'll stay. If those cubs are successful, they'll stay with those cubs for as much as 5 years. And even then, about 50% of cubs do not survive. And so you've got a species that reproduces quite slowly in comparison to wolves. They use their habitat much differently. They're much more of wilderness obligates. They need that protected wild land without roads, without peoples, and they tend to stick to it. So while I think it is a legitimate question, and there may be instances if this population recovers over the coming decades, where maybe in the spring when they're looking for some sedge grasses or a lowland food source, it's low in elevation, they may come down into some of the surrounding river valleys, but it's not going to be like what we've seen with wolves. It's not going to be frequent, and it's certainly not going to be for many years.
I would say probably the closest correlation people would make would be black bears, right? So people see black bears, those are somewhat prominent. You see them around, but so they're not going to be in the same areas as black bears that we would see.
Yeah, that actually raises some really interesting topics, because black bears and grizzly bears evolved in very different landscapes. Grizzly bears originally evolved in some of the more flat, either tundra or alpine meadow type conditions, whereas black bears were more of a forest creature that evolved where their defense mechanism was to head up a tree. They were much use their habitat in different ways, a lot more adaptable to different types of habitat. And we see that today, from black bears in the suburbs to black bears in the heart of the wilderness. And because of that, not only do we have a heck of a lot more black bears all across the West than we do grizzly bears. In fact, in Washington, we've got about 30,000 black bears and maybe 60 grizzly bears. And that's generous from the grizzly bear side. But they use their habitat much different, and they're much more willing to exist in that either suburban landscape or urban-rural interface, where they exist right alongside with people. And maybe you see them, maybe you don't, but they're pretty good at adapting to that sort of human impacted area. It's just not the case with grizzly bears. And I think both because of the limited numbers, even if grizzly restoration of the North Cascades went forward, and the way that grizzly bears use their habitat, it wouldn't necessarily correlate to the way we interact with black bears.
Okay. Well, Lisa Morante, she had a really good question. Where would these bears be taken from in order to, where would they get them to bring them in for the restoration?
That's a great question. And I guess just first I should say that, as we talked about, no decisions have been made just yet. It's still the point in the process where the National Park Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service are taking input on a series of proposals. Three of those proposals are what they call action alternatives that would augment the existing North Cascades grizzly bear population with bears from elsewhere. One is a no action alternative, which would continue some of the management actions that have been ongoing in the Cascades for the last 30 years since it was designated a grizzly bear recovery area, but would not take any action to bring bears in. So it's still pending whether decision will be made to take restoration actions in this ecosystem. I certainly hope that they do, and a number of scientists that I work with believe that there really is no other choice. If we want these bears to persist in our region, we have to take some sort of action. That the current do-nothing approach and hope they come back has not been sufficient. And I can talk a little bit about why that's the case. But we're expecting a record of decision, is what they call it, sometime in either late 2017 or early 2018. And that will also be up for public comment. So we're a little over a year away from finding out what's next with this. But if it did move forward, the answer to the question is it would either be from Northwest Montana, the area around Glacier National Park, what they call the Northern Continental Divide ecosystem. This is an area with around 1,000 bears, mostly the Bob Marshall Wilderness Complex and Glacier National Park. It's a pretty healthy bear population. It's one that may be nearing its carrying capacity. And most importantly, it's got really similar habitat to the North Cascades. It has a bit of a wetter west side and a bit of a drier east side. Somewhat similar elevation, somewhat similar food sources. It'd be a great candidate to bring bears to the North Cascades. The other likely candidate would be an area in, I guess it would be central eastern British Columbia, north of the Purcell Mountains. There's a provincial park up there whose name is escaping me right now, but that is the other potential candidate for bringing bears in. It's another place that has a healthy population of bears comparatively. It's got similar habitat, similar food sources, and the way that would work is that they would be typically young bears and bears that have no history of conflict with humans. And that's an important piece that I think a lot of people need to be aware of, is that if we do bring bears in from Montana or from eastern British Columbia, these are bears that have no history of conflict with humans, would adapt well to the ecosystem based on their food sources and the habitat they're used to, and that sort of restoration project process would be done in a way that involves the public, involves community leaders, and is done in a manner that is good for the bears as well. We would want to take good care of them as we're moving them over.
Yeah. Well, I've also heard too that when bears are coming into a new area, usually the males kind of tend to migrate a little bit further than the females. And maybe that is because of the cubs like you were talking about. Is that a concern?
Yeah, there are instances of that. And there have been other places, Northwest Montana is the main one, where this sort of restoration action has been taken with grizzly bears. Thankfully, we in the North Cascades don't need to reinvent the wheel here. It's something that they've been doing in Northwest Montana for about 20 years. So there's a lot of experience to learn from. And that is one thing that they need to consider, is typically male bears that are kind of in the prime of their age that have established a habitat, they're more likely to go on a walkabout after being moved. So it really underscores the desire to bring in young females in particular, who are going to be more likely to just set up shop and establish a new territory, and young males as well. You definitely need to have both, obviously.
Hey, one of the ways to support the show is go over to patreon.com/CascadeHikerPodcast. Become a patron for as little as $1 a month or a little bit more. We got quite a few people checking that out, and we got a couple other people that have become patrons. Now it's your turn. Support the show. Thanks a lot. Also, this show is brought to you by Rivertime Brewing Company in Darrington, Washington, where their motto is beer at an appropriate pace. Get $1 off your first pint. Tell them the Cascade Hiker Podcast sent you. That's right, I got you a deal. Go check them out. Darrington, Washington, Rivertime Brewing Company. Also, this episode is brought to you by Hiker Trash. Go to wearehikertrash.com. Check out the hats, the shirts, the stickers, and the tattoos. Hiker Trash is a pretty cool name for hikers, especially in the long-distance hiking world. Hiker Trash just means a community. Hiker Trash know each other. They're friends. They've been through a lot on the trail together. So get a shirt and represent Hiker Trash. We are Hiker Trash. Thanks, sponsors. Back to the show. I think one of the biggest concerns, and, you know, I didn't honestly, it kind of slipped my mind until George Winters sent me an email, and he had a great question. And I don't know that you're necessarily, because like you said, you're not affiliated directly with the parks or anything like that, government. But where do you think, like, the funding would come? I think his biggest point was talking about, like, bear boxes and, you know, permits and, you know, ranger inspections, that type of thing.
Yeah, I guess I can answer that in two parts. And the first part is that the funding for this environmental impact statement, the thing that's being conducted by the Park Service and the Fish and Wildlife Service that we're about halfway through, that has come primarily from two sources. It's come from the Park Service, and it's come from the Skagit Environmental Endowment, which is an endowment set up to mitigate some of the impacts of the dams on the Skagit River. That's money that can be applied to various conservation initiatives in that area. Which is really a great trade-off for having those dams in that ecosystem, which certainly have some negative effects, but then using some of the funding from the electricity those dams generate to put back into that ecosystem. So that's where the money that comes from, that's where the money that's funding the EIS is coming from. It's not hunting licenses. It's not, you know, the passes you pay for at the trailhead. It's from the Park Service General Fund and from the Environmental Endowment. Now, that funding doesn't extend through to after the EIS is completed. So bear restoration and management would need to come from either renewed sources from those entities or from new sources. But what I can say is that because this area has been designated a grizzly bear recovery zone since 1991, a lot of that structure is already in place. We have multiple agencies from the Department of Fish and Wildlife of Washington State to the U.S. Forest Service, Okanagan-Wenatchee National Forest, Mount Baker-Snoqualmie National Forest, to the National Park Complex, which is North Cascades National Park Complex, which is really the anchor of this ecosystem. All of these agencies are already operating as if there are grizzly bears in this area. And in fact, there are very few. So much of the policy, whether it's ranger education on bear safety or bear safe boxes, food boxes at campsites or access management for grizzly bears, that stuff has already been in place. And I think it's really important for people to know that that area is already managed and funded for grizzly bears. So the fact that there would be a few more, likely somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 25 over the coming decade in this ecosystem, wouldn't have a significant impact on the overall management and funding. What would be potentially expensive is bringing those bears in, you know, the physical restoration process. But I think the Park Service and the other agencies have their eye on different funding sources, and we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I mean, I didn't even think about the funding for bringing them in. Well, what do you know what the process is for actually extracting them and bringing them in? Do you know how to walk through that process?
Yeah, I can talk about it really briefly. So one of the things that Conservation Northwest did as part of this effort is we've been really trying to educate folks on the fact that this has been done elsewhere in Montana, and that it was done through a really successful collaborative process with local communities, biologists, Native American tribes, and other partners. And so we've got a great 13-minute video on our Facebook page, on our website, on our Grizzly Bear website, which is northcascadesgrizzly.org. with a good friend of ours who's a BBC and PBS Nature filmmaker. His name's Chris Morgan. And what he did is he went to Northwest Montana, to the Cabinet Mountains, and talked to bear biologists and local community leaders and hunters and hikers, and asked them what they thought about the bear restoration process there. And it's got some really great details on how the community was involved and how they actually did this, how they took bears from the Glacier National Park area and moved them into the Cabinet Mountains where the population was struggling. And in short, what it is you set up a culvert trap, which is a large circular trap on a trailer. You bait it with typically roadkill deer. You'll often put up a game cam nearby to be able to see what's going on at the trap. Maybe a bear or another animal come in, check it out, but not go into the trap. If a bear enters the trap, there's a piece of bait that's on a pull cord. And when that cord is activated, the door on the trap falls. And the biologists will either get a notification depending on the way the trap is set up, or they will go out and check it on a regular basis. And if they get a bear that meets the criteria for restoration, so again, that's a typically a young bear, a bear that has no history of conflict with humans, and it's targeted in a manner so that these are bears that have habitat that's similar to the habitat where they would potentially be reintroduced or restored. They'll take that bear and they'll hitch it up. They'll hitch the whole vehicle up to a truck. They'll drive it over to the area where it's going to be restored, either before doing so or before it's actually released. They'll do a full health screening. They'll check the teeth. They'll check the health. They'll check the sex. They'll take weight and size measurements. In some cases, they may give it vaccines, which is pretty standard for wildlife capture efforts. You want to make sure that if you're moving an animal or if you're even just doing a research project that you can use non-invasive techniques, but also do it in a manner that does everything you can to support the health and the success of that species in its new location. So the bear will get a quick checkup, and it's going to be sedated during that process just because it's less stressful for the animal. They'll drive it out to a remote area of the area where it's going to be released, whether that's the end of a long forest road, or in some cases, they'll even use a helicopter to pick up the entire culvert trap and bring it into an area of quality habitat that's a long ways from human development. At this point, typically what they do is let the bear come to. You know, you don't want to just drop an animal off while it's sedated. That puts it in a very vulnerable state. You know, maybe it's groggy and it's going to run across a pack of wolves. That's not going to be good for restoring the species. So you let the animal come to, typically in the culvert trap where it's at least protected. And once it's back and in a healthy state, all the health exam stuff has been checked off. It's in an area where research has shown to be high quality habitat and low likelihood for human conflict. You'll let it go. And the last thing that's a part of that is that afterwards, there's a significant amount of monitoring that goes on. These animals are either fitted with GPS collars or VHF tracking collars. And it's important for this sort of restoration process where you have a really small amount of individual animals and you're really banking on them to help restore a population to be able to have monitoring to gauge the success of that initiative. So in the example of Pacific Fisher Restoration in the Cascades, which is a project I've been part of, we've been monitoring the about 100 fishers that we've restored in the Cascades in the last 2 years. And that's given us some indications around mortality, around the way they're using the habitat, spreading out across the Cascades, where we should consider for future restoration sites, some things we might do differently for future years. And much would be the same with grizzly bears. They would keep track of these animals to inform the success of the project and the next steps. So I hope that's a good overview for you. And that's a really good question about how it would be done.
Great. Yeah, it just kind of came to me as you were talking there. Well, Kim Brown, I hit her up for a lot of questions. She's got a lot of knowledge of the backcountry. She wants to know, she's from a gateway community, and she's just kind of curious, like, how are these communities feel? What do they feel about it so far? You know, as they've been having these meetings and such things, what's the word back from the communities themselves?
Yeah, so I've been to a number of these grizzly bear meetings as well as briefings in some of the local communities around the North Cascades. And I'm really lucky to do a lot of my work with ranchers and outfitters and others that really depend on these wild places for their livelihoods. And in doing so, they interact with animals like grizzly bears or wolves. And what I'd say is that it's been mixed. You know, there are certainly concerns and they're legitimate concerns that deserve answers. But at the same time, there's a lot of enthusiasm and interest and understanding that some of these people, they choose to live in these communities around wild places or in the heart of wild places. I was talking to a gentleman up in Mazama not long ago. You know, that's about as central into this grizzly bear recovery zone as you can get.
Yeah.
And they choose to live in these places because they're near wildness. They're near wilderness. They're near wildlife. They're near things that really connect us with our natural heritage. And I think a lot of people recognize that grizzly bears are a part of that heritage. And while there are questions, there are concerns about safety or access or conflict with livestock, when the information gets out there, I've found that a lot of people, whether it's information about limitations on how bears would impact our access, which is really not a factor, because it's been managed for grizzly bears for 30 years, or whether it's questions about bear safety, which there's some really straightforward things people can do to stay safe in bear country. The more that information gets across, I think the more some of these people in these communities are open to it, simply because they often live here for the same thing that the grizzly bear provides, which is a sense of wildness.
Cool. Kim Brown also had a question. She said, that with this grizzly restoration in the North Cascades, is that going to hurt any future wilderness advocacy? If there's a lot of bears, like what are they expecting this population to grow to? Is that going to hurt your restoration with, say, the fisher or the wolves?
No, I think what I'd say to that is that they're pretty siloed. We don't consider the state of one endangered or threatened species when we're trying to recover another necessarily, unless there are impacts across the species, like one preying on the other, which really isn't an issue for wolves or grizzly bears or fishers. We wouldn't expect, say, the fisher restoration in the North Cascades, which is going to be ramping up in the year ahead, to be in any way impacted by ongoing grizzly bear restoration efforts. And again, because the North Cascades has been managed for grizzly bears for several decades now, we wouldn't expect any changes to wilderness designations or other wildland protection efforts. We wouldn't expect any significant or permanent trail or road closures in the area. And that's an important point I think a lot of people aren't aware of or kind of think the worst about, that because bears will be back, that their favorite trail might be closed. And that's just unlikely to be the case unless it's a temporary closure. And as far as the number of bears that would be back, the main numbers to keep in mind are the proposed alternatives that include restoration lay out some short-term goals, typically 25 bears after restoration is complete, and that would be over a 5 to 10 year period. But the population goal is set at about 200 bears. And while that may sound like a lot, it's highly unlikely that it would be reached in anything less than a century. So this is a long-term project.
Great. Reese Williams wants to know, he lived in the grizzly area in eastern Washington by northern Idaho. And, he noticed that there was a lot of large game over there. And he wants to know, what are the grizzly bears probably, what are they expecting them to be, preying on? And is there enough of that large game in the area, if that is what it is, for them to feed on?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I got to say, I'm a hunter, and most of my time spent in the North Cascades. I love to hike. I love to backpack, but typically I'm backpacking to scout for hunting season and backpack hunting in the fall. So this is an important issue to me and to a lot of my colleagues. One of the key things to keep in mind as we consider this question is that grizzly bears are not predators. These are omnivores. They spend most of their time throughout the year feeding on insects, on vegetation, on berries. These aren't coastal brown bears, so they're not feeding on fish. I mean, if they can, there might be a few places in the Cascades where they'll interact with fish, but it's pretty limited. They will in the spring, if they can, they'll take some deer and elk calves, but they're really not highly effective hunters. They're much better at stealing cougar and wolf kills than they are at actually killing ungulates. They will feed on ground squirrels and marmots and pikas, things like that. Those big claws that they have, those are actually shovels for digging. So they will pursue those small mammals. But typically in interior grizzly bear populations like we have here in the North Cascades or in Yellowstone or northern Montana, as much as 75 to 80% of a grizzly bear's diet is vegetation. So in the North Cascades, there's over 100 different types of plants that are significant grizzly bear foods. So we've got a lot of vegetation for them to eat. We've got really good, high quality wet habitat up around Ross Lake and on the western slopes of the Cascades. That's really rich in vegetation that feeds grizzly bears. We can anticipate that a high level of their diets as they recover and for the bears that are up there now are made up of plant matter. And that's not to say they wouldn't occasionally take an elk or a deer calf, but I would not in any means expect that these animals would have an impact on ungulate populations in the North Cascades.
Hey, one of the ways to support the show is go over to patreon.com/CascadeHikerPodcast. Become a patron for as little as $1 a month or a little bit more. We got quite a few people checking that out, and we got a couple other people that have become patrons. Now it's your turn. Support the show. Thanks a lot. Also, this show is brought to you by Rivertime Brewing Company in Darrington, Washington, where their motto is beer at an appropriate pace. Get a dollar off your first pint. Tell them the Cascade Hiker Podcast sent you. That's right, I got you a deal. Go check them out. Darrington, Washington, Rivertime Brewing Company. Also, this episode is brought to you by Hiker Trash. Go to wearehikertrash.com. Check out the hats, the shirts, the stickers, and the tattoos. Hiker Trash is a pretty cool name for hikers, especially in the long-distance hiking world. Hiker Trash just means a community. Hiker Trash know each other. They're friends. They've been through a lot on the trail together. So get a shirt and represent Hiker Trash. wearehikertrash.com. Thanks, sponsors. Back to the show. Well, John Soltis, he's been on the podcast before. You know, he wants to know, what is the plan if bears start causing too much trouble? Or what type of trouble would they cause? Like towards us or towards anything?
Yeah, and that's again, I think questions like that are entirely legitimate. You know, I'm someone that approaches this issue, and my organization, Conservation Northwest, does as well, where we don't want to undermine or cast aside questions about conflict, about access, about human safety. You know, these are important things to consider as we consider this topic. And so it's important to get the right information out there. What I would say in regards to conflicts with these animals is a couple things. And the first being, again, these aren't wolves. So we wouldn't expect a high level of livestock conflict like we see with wolves, like we see with coyotes. Not to say it's not possible, but, and I know that there's some ranchers in places like Montana that do have irregular conflicts with grizzly bears, particularly in the spring when they're calving. But we wouldn't expect that to be significant in the North Cascades for a couple reasons. And the primary one is that most of the North Cascades is designated wilderness. And the areas where the grizzly bear introductions would occur would be in those designated wilderness areas. So we don't have any livestock grazing there. So that really nearly negates or greatly reduces the likelihood of livestock conflicts. There just simply aren't livestock there, and there may be out in some of the periphery areas around the ecosystem, but they're not going to be in the areas where restoration would occur. If there were instances where a bear moved on out of those wilderness areas, out of the national park, and came down into the areas where there are livestock, that's where a really interesting piece of this issue might be brought forward. And what that is it's called a 10J designation. And bear with me for a minute because it's going to get a little bit wonky. But what a 10J designation is, it's a section of the Endangered Species Act. And grizzly bears are an animal that's listed under the Endangered Species Act in the lower 48. But what a 10J designation means is it's an experimental designated population. So it's a population that's been designated separate from the overall endangered population across the region that's listed. And it excludes that population from some of the basic requirements of the Endangered Species Act. It doesn't undermine the recovery or the efforts that agencies and other stakeholders are doing to bring these endangered animals back, but it gives them a greater degree of flexibility in a case like that grizzly bear that might wander down out of the mountains towards OMAC, where there may be a sheep operation. It does give them the flexibility to move that animal, to respond to its radio collar that's showing that it's heading down towards that sheep operation. It enables them to go and to find it and to take it and move it back into the heart of the Cascades. And if in a worst case scenario where you had an animal that just really wasn't working out, it was having clear indication that it was repeatedly getting into conflict with livestock or people, you would be able to take management action or lethal action against that individual animal under a 10J designation. And that getting that 10J designation for a population like the North Cascades is a bit of a complicated process. It's one that's running parallel or would run parallel with the environmental impact statement for grizzly bear restoration. But if approved, it's one that gives wildlife managers and local landowners or other constituents a lot more flexibility for how to manage these animals once they're back on the livestock and once they're back on the landscape. And I think it's one that if people were to learn a little bit more about, it might ease some of their fears about how conflicts would be handled if they did occur. Now, the other type of conflict to be considering would be human conflict. And again, the North Cascades is a huge wild area. We're talking about more than 10,000 square miles, and I think somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 million square acres. It's a large landscape, much of it wilderness, much of it backcountry without roads. It's highly unlikely we'd have a lot of human-bear interaction with a bear population that's less than 25, even after restoration, in this size of a landscape. But again, people need to be aware of what it means to recreate in bear country, what bear safe practices are, how they keep a clean camp, and some of the other things that they do. And if you do all that with really those straightforward bear safe precautions, it's going to be pretty unlikely that we'd have serious human bear conflicts in the near term over this process.
All right. Well, kind of a follow up right along with that. Lisa Morante also asked, how will they protect them from poachers?
Yeah, that's an important thing to consider. And, you know, we hate to see any sort of poaching. It's awful when you've got it, especially with endangered species, but any other species, you know, really puts a bad name on hunters. It puts a black mark on wildlife conservation, and it's certainly something to consider. The first piece of that is that much of the area where this restoration project would occur, the anchor of this ecosystem, as I said, is a national park, North Cascades National Park Complex. So there's no hunting as it is now in that area. Not a lot of people out carrying guns, and, you know, nothing against hunters. As I said, I am one, but typically the people that do the poaching are the guys that happen to be carrying a rifle. So you don't have as much of that in the North Cascades. And I think that takes away some of the likelihood of bear poaching. You'd have to have a circumstance where someone came across one of these bears and was carrying a rifle and had the bad intent to poach it. And that's going to be a lot less likely in the North Cascades National Park. Some of the surrounding wilderness areas, there are popular backcountry hunting seasons, but I'm of the belief that most of the people that are taking part in those backcountry backpack or horseback style hunting are typically people that have a good sense of what wilderness is and why it's important. And I'd hope are not people that are going to be taking part in poaching of an endangered species. But there are, this is where enforcement comes in. You've got forest rangers and Department of Fish and Wildlife wardens or law enforcement officers, and it's their job to reduce and prevent poaching for any species, including endangered ones like grizzly bears. And that's not to say that they're Superman and they can do it perfect in every instance. It's a big ecosystem with not a lot of, perhaps it could use some more enforcement presence, but I know those guys are going to be trying their hardest to prevent poaching of any species, and in particular one as special as grizzly bears.
Okay. Well, the next question comes from Joel Eid, and I just want to say that, he's one of the guys that got me into podcasting. He was the very first hiking podcast I ever listened to, the Kings Canyon Outdoors podcast, but he no longer does it. There's only 18 episodes. You can still find it on iTunes. But anyway, Joel Eid, he wanted to ask, and this is something I kind of was wondering too, because I've heard that there's already, that the grizzly should maybe possibly be already considered not endangered. And so his actual question is, some would say there are plenty of grizzlies in overall numbers throughout the U.S., and others would say they are not in nearly enough of the historic habitats of the past. Does the ESA mean like just numbers or the spread of locales?
Yeah, so I'm going to kind of have to answer this fairly broad as not an official representative of the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Park Service, but I'll do my best. And what I'd say to that is that it's broken out into different distinct populations. So right now we've got the Yellowstone population, which is in all likelihood is near or past recovery objectives. There's certainly some debate about that. And some are looking to delist that population or to label it as recovered and hand over the management of the Yellowstone grizzly bear population to state wildlife agencies. To the north, you've got that Northern Continental Divide ecosystem or that Glacier National Park, Bob Marshall Wilderness Complex grizzly bear population. It's in a similar state, maybe not quite as far along as the Yellowstone, just because of the size of that landscape and its greater carrying capacity for grizzly bears. But it's an area that's doing quite well and in the not too distant future might be considered recovered. So in general, the ESA looks at these species in accordance with populations. And here in the North Cascades, despite 10,000 square miles of rugged, wild public lands wilderness, our population is not doing well. And the habitat's still there, the food sources are still there. But because of isolation with from the other grizzly bear populations, because the grizzly bear populations to the north in Canada are across the Fraser River Valley and disconnected from the North Cascades, and they're also not doing well. So when you have a small struggling population in southern Canada, it's unlikely to send bears off to recolonize the North Cascades. And because of that really low reproductive rate that I mentioned earlier with grizzly bears and some overhunting in the early 1900s, you have a combination where that North Cascades population, unlike the ones in Yellowstone or in Glacier National Park area, is not doing well. And so you have to break it out. The ESA does not look at the bear across all of its historic range. It looks at it in accordance with populations.
Okay. Kathy Bellinger, she's somebody that has a question that I love this kind of stuff because I personally am not worried about anything out there. I've never been concerned. I don't know, though. I've never hiked and camped, backpacked in a grizzly area, so I don't know how I feel about that yet. But I'm game for just about anything. But Kathy, she says in the areas of like healthy populations of grizzlies, like Yellowstone or Montana, what is the statistics regarding attacks and deaths?
Yeah, I was interested in that too. And I recently pulled up some information on it because I'd have a little bit better understanding. I've seen bears in Alaska, grizzly bears in Alaska and in Yellowstone, but I haven't had any close encounters with them personally. I haven't had to use my bear spray or anything like that. So I can't speak from my personal experience, but what I can speak to is the data. And what the data shows is that in Yellowstone, you have approximately a 1 in 2.7 million chance of having a negative encounter with grizzly bears. And what that means is that over the last 35 years, there's been about 1.5 million people that have visited Yellowstone. That's more than 3 million annually on average. And over that course of time, there's been 38 negative interactions between grizzly bears and people that have been recorded. There have been a couple fatalities. There was one in 2016. One in 2015, two in 2011, and then before that, the last one was in 1986. So they're certainly infrequent. And it's important to consider that, an area like Yellowstone with 3 million visitors a year and more than 700 bears, that's actually a lot denser human visitation than what we see in the North Cascades. And that may be counterintuitive to people because people think, oh, it's Washington, it's 2 hours from Seattle, it's really crowded. Well, actually, no, not when you compare it with Yellowstone and you think about the backcountry of the North Cascades and the limited road access and the fact that North Cascades National Park typically sees fewer than 300,000 people per year compared to that 3 million in Yellowstone. So, it is something to consider. You should absolutely be taking bear safe hiking and camping practices, know what those are, know how to use your bear spray. And I'm happy to talk a little bit more about some of those precautions. But, we like to say, and I know a lot of scientists will say this too, the most dangerous thing about any trip to grizzly bear country is the drive to the trailhead. Statistically, you have a far greater chance of getting in a car wreck or getting attacked by a dog or any number of things, slipping and falling on the trail, than you do having a negative encounter with a grizzly bear.
Yeah, I like that. That's good. All right. Jerry Riss wanted to ask, and I'm just going to read his question full out here. Please ask them if they follow sound biology in deciding what they support and don't support, or do they follow emotions such as the bears are harmless, the bears are terribly dangerous?
The way I'd respond to that is that my organization, Conservation Northwest, and the biologists and policymakers and experts that I work with at the state and federal wildlife agencies, including the National Park Service, we stick to the facts and we stick to science. And if we do have emotion involved, it's a sentiment and an ethic that guides us towards recovering and protecting and conserving our natural heritage, whether that's wilderness or wildlife like grizzly bears. That's the emotion. It's not that These animals are some fairy tale, mystical species, spirit animal type thing that is can do no wrong. Nor is it that these animals are awful troublemakers, that all they do is get into conflicts with people and livestock, and you know, they don't deserve a place in these areas. No, we think about the population. We think about the health of the ecosystem. We think about the animals that are native to that ecosystem. We think about the quality habitat that still remains. I mean, I'm not someone that's going to go and say, oh, these bears should be reintroduced to the suburbs of Seattle. I mean, that I've heard a lot of people make that joke, and it's just, you know, it's not realistic. The North Cascades are one of the wildest places left in the lower 48. This is an ecosystem that's bigger than the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. It's more intact than the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. It's, you know, if you look at the spine of the Cascades from the I-90 border into Canada, you have one of the largest areas of intact wild public land left. If we can't have grizzly bears here, where can we have these animals? And that's what we think about. We don't think about, you know, they're perfect. We don't think about their evil. We think about the population and the ecosystem.
You know, I've mentioned this one time before in the podcast. And when I was at Hart's Pass, which is just up above Mazama, right, you know, real close. It's in the Pasayton, pretty close to Pasayton there. And
that's one of my favorite areas.
Oh, it's amazing. You drive right to it, hike to the Canadian border and back. And while I'm in the middle of that hike, and I talked to my hiking partner who doesn't know the mountains that well, and I looked over and I said, oh, there's Mount Baker, check it out. I mean, Mount Shuxian, check it out. And then I got up on top of this ridge, and I saw Mount Baker, and it was like way, way far away. And then I told the guy, I'm like, I'm sorry, man, there's no way that's Mount Shuxian, because Baker looks like a tiny little dot over there. And, you know, it really gives that perspective of how huge that northern North Cascades portion is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's huge.
It really is. And especially if you look at, you know, think about that area around Ross Lake and north of Highway 20. And there are so few roads, if any, there's so few trails. You think about like Devil's Dome Loop or some of those trails out of Hart's Pass or some of the stuff on the west side of Ross Lake up out of Diablo. You know, there's a few trails, but compared to what we see down in the Alpine Lakes, this is wilderness by every sense of the term. And it's big, it's wild, it's, you know, darn near pristine. We've got wolverines and wolves and soon to be fishers and maybe a few fishers now, but that's pretty unlikely. But that project is moving forward. You've got lynx. It's one of the few areas in the lower 48 where Canada lynx still persist. In fact, that Pasayton wilderness is one of the last strongholds of Canada lynx in the lower 48. It's one of the places that retains a natural quality that was there at the time of Lewis and Clark, one of the few places in the lower 48 that really can claim that title. There's one thing that's missing it by all intents and purposes, and that's grizzly bears.
Yeah. Oh, that's crazy. Well, and you know, just to kind of put a cap on that too, talking about the vastness of the territory, you know, talking to Jeff Kish, and he's the head of the PNT right now, the Pacific Northwest Trail. And mm-hmm. I talked about this in a past episode, but there's 165 miles of trail between through the Pasayton all the way to Mount Baker to Highway 542. 165 miles of straight trail with no road intersection. I mean, that's huge.
That's so neat. And I mean, it sounds like a lot, but then when you look at, you know, down near between North Bend and Leavenworth, or it's really not, you know, as far as the density of trail in this core part of the ecosystem, there's very little human impact. And it's part of what makes it so appealing to us humans. And it's also part of what it makes it such a good candidate for the recovery of large native wildlife like grizzly bears.
Yeah. Well, hey, I know you don't have a whole lot of time, but let's touch some base on some other animals. So I know I've had an episode in the past where I talked to a guy that owns a bunch of wolves, and I know that's a hot topic all the time. So what do you have to say about wolves?
Yeah, man, I spend most of a good portion of my work is in regards to wolves, and Conservation Northwest is an organization that has worked on wolf recovery, conservation, management, and coexistence for well over a decade now. And You know, I would just say that some of the things that we try to do and that some of the agencies do as well are as much about managing people as they are about managing wolves. And unlike grizzly bears, and some of this applies to grizzly bears, but more so to wolves, wolves are a species that has a large impact on the landscape. You know, you may have heard of the trophic cascade theories in Yellowstone, where the wolves started moving the elk around in a more natural manner that helped bring back the health of the watersheds from the fish to the birds to the beavers. I think there's a lot of truth to that, although it's maybe not quite as conclusive as some of the theories once thought. Wolves have a huge impact on natural landscapes and ecosystems, and they have an impact on human-altered landscapes and ecosystems, whether that's getting into conflict with livestock, really moving around that ecosystem in a visible way, in a way that humans can identify, whether that's through tracks or sightings or howling. I've had the opportunity to spend quite a bit of time up in Northeast Washington wolf country and even howl with some wolves. And wow. I mean, that was a really unbelievable experience, but it really underscored how these animals have a visible role on this landscape in a way that no other species that I'm aware of does. And with that comes some really amazing, inspiring things, you know, having them back in this native place, but it also comes with some conflicts and some challenges that we as wildlife advocates and conservationists and managers have to work through.
Yeah. Well, that's a big, big subject. And I don't know, I just, what are some of the other kind of species that you guys are working with? You mentioned the fisher.
Yeah. So for folks that don't know, fisher are a small member of the weasel family. They're a little bit bigger than a house cat, kind of similar look to a house cat, with a kind of a long, fluffy tail, low to the ground, maybe 3 feet long or a little bit longer with their tail. They have really luxurious pelts. And as you might guess, because of those luxurious pelts, they were a prime target for trapping in the 18th and 19th and 20th century, or the 19th and 20th centuries, 1800s and 1900s. That pelt, I believe, was second only to sea otter in its value. And so they were trapped to local extinction or extirpation here in Washington by the early 1900s, somewhere around 1930 or so. They did persist up in British Columbia, and there's a small population down in the Southern Cascades in Southern Oregon and Northern California, although that population is also struggling. So we had about an 80-year absence where we didn't have fishers in our state. There is another, there's some debate as to whether they're a subspecies or whether it's the same species, but there are fishers up in far New England, up in Maine and some of that area. But we didn't have them here in Washington. And fishers play an important role in mid and low elevation forest ecosystems. They feed on rodents and birds. And because they feed heavily on rats and other rodents, they play an important role in controlling those rodent populations. There are species that having them in the ecosystem makes that ecosystem more resilient to change. And that's something that's important for biologists to consider these days with changing climate. And they're another animal that's part of our natural heritage here. They're a native species that didn't go naturally extinct. Just like grizzly bears, we drove them to the brink. And I'm someone, and I think a lot of people that I work with believe that we have an obligation where quality habitat still exists to bring back species in a responsible way that are native to this landscape and to our region. Where the habitat still allows. And luckily, here in Washington, we've got some really great habitat for fishers and other species in places like the Olympic Peninsula, around Mount Rainier, and in the North Cascades. So Conservation Northwest has been partnering with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife and the National Park Service since the mid-2000s to reintroduce fishers to our state. And we worked with trappers up in central British Columbia, primarily First Nations trappers who are already trapping fishers for their fur. They've got a pretty healthy population up there, and there's some trapping that's ongoing. And we work with them to live capture these animals. And we kind of like that process with grizzly bears I laid out. We gave them extensive health checks, vaccines. We did a little bit of selecting for females in particular. And since around 2008 after a number of studies and some environmental impact statement processes here led by the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. We reintroduced about 100 onto the Olympic Peninsula from 2008 to 2012. There's been some mortality there, but the population is reproducing successfully. They've documented subsequent generations of fishers out on the Olympic Peninsula. And then just in the last few years, we moved that reintroduction project to the South Cascades around Mount Rainier. And we've reintroduced about 90 fishers into the Gifford Pinchot National Forest and just this last year into Mount Rainier National Park. And that was a really special thing to see Native American tribes, biologists. We had some local school children that were a part of the release, all coming together to release this native species back into Mount Rainier National Park that had been gone for more than 80 years. It was just a really special event. We've been following that up with some monitoring to gauge the success of the program. It seems like the fishers are doing well. They're adapting well to the habitat. You know, it's just like the area they came from in central British Columbia. It's wet, it's mossy, it's good quality forest. And then next year, that project will be moving to the North Cascades, to North Cascades National Park and Mount Maker-Snoqualmie National Forest in particular. And it's a really neat thing to be a part of. It's bringing back a species that belongs here. Unlike some of those larger creatures, they don't have quite the same level of conflict. And we've been able to work with a lot of the landowners and timber companies in the area to make sure that they have the right information about this process and whether there'll be any impacts to them. But overall, people have been really supportive of the fisher reintroduction. And I think it's been a great blueprint and learning experience for these agencies and the public in regards to how wildlife reintroduction can work.
Real quick, what about the wolverine?
Yeah, now that's if there's one species I like working on, it's the wolverine. And they are just wilderness superheroes, man. I've seen collar data from a wolverine, I think it was in Montana, that went up and down these couloirs, these icy chutes that you couldn't climb with an ice axe and crampons. Wow. And it just ran right up them. I mean, these are animals that are active all winter long in high elevation areas. They're one of the only large mammals that actually are active all winter long. They're out there feeding on winter killed deer and elk. They'd spend get a lot of their food from mountain goats and other species that are killed by avalanches. They are just tenacious critters, and we are really lucky here in the North Cascades that they are coming back on their own. There is a population of wolverines just over the border in Canada, and that population has been a source population. And over the last decade or so, wolverines have been expanding southward into the North Cascades, as far as I-90, with potentially an individual that was recently documented south of I-90. Right now, I think the estimate is somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 to about three dozen in the North Cascades, so still a small and tenuous population. But they're a species that ranges really widely, more so than grizzly bears. They do also reproduce slowly, but because of what appears to be some connectivity to wolverine populations to the north, they're coming back on their own. And us, Conservation Northwest, along with state and federal biologists, are doing what we can to monitor that recovery. But at this point, it doesn't appear that they really need our help. They are really tough critters, and they seem to be coming back well. I've been lucky enough to support a couple different wolverine research surveys up in the just outside the Glacier Peak Wilderness in the central North Cascades. And I've been doing that for about 3 years now, monitoring a couple different run poles or wolverine documentation stations we've set up to lure in a wolverine with some scent lure. We've got a couple remote cameras. And because wolverines have a chest blaze that's unique to the individual animals, it's kind of like a thumbprint or a chest blaze on a dog. Everyone is unique. So if you can get a picture of that chest blaze, you can get a sense of the population, the numbers, what animals are in what areas, how they're using their ranges. And so in my instance, we monitored this site for 3 years, and just last summer finally got a picture of one wolverine. So there's definitely not a lot of them out there. They're really elusive, but they are a super cool creature, and it's just amazing to have them back in this ecosystem.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, hey, man, I don't want to keep you too long. Why don't you tell me a little bit about Conservation Northwest, though? Like, how can people reach out to you? What can they do to help?
Yeah, so I just want to say really quick, one thing we haven't got into is kind of bear safety and bear awareness. Instead of me talking about it for 15 minutes, because I could go on and on about this subject, I highly recommend that folks go on the web, and we've got a website. It's northcascadesgrizzly.org. And there's a lot of information about the North Cascades grizzly bear restoration process. You can submit a comment to the public agencies through our site. There's a lot of different information about testimonials from different people, Native American tribes, hikers, hunters, conservationists, about why they feel like this is an important issue. But one of the other things we have is we have a whole frequently asked questions page and a resources page with a lot of really good information about bear safety. And some of this is really straightforward stuff, like not cooking in the same place you sleep, or not bringing food into the tent at night, or carrying bear spray and knowing how to use it, which is really important. You know, don't just buy your bear spray, actually do some research on how to use it. But there's some great videos. We've got a one page that you can actually print out and take with you that has some information about bear identification, you know, how to tell a black bear from a grizzly bear, some things to look for, some more information about bear safe hiking and camping practices, or if you live or work in bear country, things that you can do. These are important things, and they're important things to consider, but they're really straightforward. And I highly recommend anyone that's nervous about this issue or nervous and scared about bears in general, information is the key. And the more you know, I think the more comfortable you're going to be with bears in general. And there's a lot of great information online. So you can find it in a Google search, or you can go to northcascadesgrizzly.org, and we've got some great resources. In regards to Conservation Northwest, we work on a lot of different wildlife and wilderness issues here in this state. We try to take a pragmatic approach that recognizes the needs and values of people, right along with the needs of endangered and rare and recovering wildlife and wild places. And we find that by combining those two and really bringing people into the picture and working across barriers and divisions, working collaboratively, we get a lot done. And so if people want to learn more about that, you can go to conservationnw.org. We really value your support. Memberships and donations are what make us run. But we also value people that are willing to take action and lend their voice to important issues, from wilderness to wildlife recovery. So it's a lot of information about our organization and what we do and how you can get involved at conservationnw.org.
All right, man. Well, hey, Chase, thanks for coming on the Cascade Hiker Podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. I can't wait to listen to some of your other interviews that are coming out. And thanks for having me.
Okay, that's the show. Thanks a lot for listening to the Cascade Hiker Podcast. Send me an email, rudy@cascadehikerpodcast.com. I love the feedback. Also, hit me up on Facebook. North Cascade Hiker is my Facebook page. Twitter, capital N underscore capital C for Cascade Hiking. N underscore Cascade Hiking on Twitter. And Instagram is North Cascade underscore Hiker. So pretty simple to find me on social media there. You can also just leave a comment under the show. So I try to give you plenty of ways to get a hold of me. Do so. I want to hear from you. Thanks again for listening to the Cascade Hiker Podcast. I would leave this world for a beautiful girl if I could just find you.